You're standing in the supermarket and picking out your head of lettuce. You want a big round head of lettuce with a nice color to it. You want your money's worth. But nature doesn't always make lettuce that matches your needs as a consumer. For example, a zucchini that's over 7 inches long won't make the cut for that beautiful display in your supermarket. Or sweet corn. Did you know, for instance, that most farmers only pick the top ear of the stalk? And the second and third ear may be less juicy or plump. So where does it all go? I'm Jabalani LaFall. On today's Central Standard, a look at the problem of food waste across the country and how one area group, along with the grassroots network of congregations and civil organizations, are helping to feed the hungry in our metro and across the region. Last year alone, this network moved about 2.6 million pounds of fresh produce. Join us for a discussion on how it all comes together on Central Standard following this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, more than 40 million Americans face food insecurity each year. Insecurity, of course, is a euphemism for not knowing where their next meal is coming from. Yet nearly 40% of crops that are grown nationwide are wasted. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Today we examine the disparity between wasted crops and U.S. citizens that go hungry by discussing the mandate and activities of a local group that gets fresh produce from gleaning farmers' fields and salvaging produce deemed unmarketable, and then giving them to food banks and food service organizations for the underprivileged. Our guests today are Lisa Owsley, the director of the Society of St. Andrew, or SOSA West, the organization covering the region of the country west of the Mississippi, and John Hornbeck of the Episcopal Community Services. Welcome both of you to Central Standard.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, Lisa, how does a program such as SOSA West work? Tell us about the organization.
Well, the Society of St. Andrew, we work with farmers and growers to get produce that's been graded out. It's either excess or graded out. And we simply get that produce to people who can't afford to buy their groceries. It's a simple concept, poetry, we call it. Common sense, just saving produce that's perfectly good to eat and getting it to people who can't afford to buy the groceries.
Why do you call it poetry?
Because it's just common sense. It's simple. It's what we should be doing. It's a beautiful. I think it's a beautiful concept. It's a beautiful organization. We have been working for 33 years to get fresh, delicious, nutritious produce, fruits and vegetables, to people who can't afford to buy their food.
John Hornbeck, tell us about the problem of hunger in our area specifically.
Episcopal Community Services basically is an organization that through our Episcopal Hunger Relief Network provides food to the hungry through food pantries, community kitchens, specialized hunger relief programs to a wide range of different people. What we're finding is two different things. Number one, a tremendous growth in terms of the degree of hunger in the greater Kansas City area. And secondly, we're seeing so many new faces in these programs. In several of our food pantries, for example, one of them that's located over on 40th and Main, one of the things that we are seeing is typically anywhere from 20 to 30% of the individuals visiting those pantries have not ever visited them in the past. So these are all new faces. And again, a wide range of demographic. We see single people. We see families with young children. We see grandparents who are raising children without parents in the home. We see college students that are coming to pantries because with no summer jobs the last couple of summers, they're facing problems going to school and still being able to afford food. So, again, increasing need, decreasing resources to fill that need. And that's one of the places that SOSA comes in and becomes very important, is helping to fill that resource gap.
So, John, the causes are the same, but the effects are different.
The causes are the same. Unemployment is high on the list of causes. The simple lack of available food can be a problem as well. Some of our neighborhoods are what have been termed as food deserts, areas where it's very challenging for people to access food. Through our Meals on Wheels program, We're seeing increasing lists of individuals we're helping through that program, where with an aging community, there's more and more individuals that are homebound and have problems getting out for food. So, yes, the reasons, the causes are the same, but the impact of those causes has expanded tremendously.
Lisa, the food that makes its way to these pantries and these food service organizations and these kitchens are examples of produce that isn't deemed marketable. Tell us about that.
Well, and this is shocking. A lot of people don't understand this. Produce is graded out for what we call cosmetic reasons. It simply doesn't meet the standards our consumers have for the produce that they want to buy. For example, if a zucchini is 10 inches long, it's graded out. Granted, zucchini does get tough after a while, but there's nothing wrong with a zucchini that's 10 inches long. It's just doesn't – it's not the same size. All they want their zucchinis all to be 6 to 7 inches long, so they line up neatly on the shelf in your grocery store.
Who makes the standard of whether something is marketable or not? And when you find out that it's not,
well,
how do you proceed?
Well, I'm sure the standards are set by the industry. I don't understand who says something isn't marketable, because there's so much good food out there that goes to waste. But whenever we're given a call to come and glean a field, what happens is that we work with a farmer to gather what's left after he's done harvesting. And so we'll go into that farm. Maybe the farm field was harvested by mechanical equipment, or maybe it was harvested by pickers, you know, individuals who go through and do the first grading out process right there in the field. They see something on the vine and they think, oh, that zucchini is 10 inches long. It's not going to make the grade. So they leave it right there in the field.
So most of the time they know at the point of harvest,
yes, yeah,
whether or not it's going to be marketable.
Yeah, you know, you can pick up a red pepper, pick a bell pepper, and see a mark on the back and know that that's not going to be – no one's going to buy that, so you just leave it on the vine. There's a lot of food left in the fields after the harvest. And again, mechanical equipment does a lot of that too, because it mechanical equipment can't dip through the valleys of the field and catch the corners. So food is left behind.
But this doesn't affect the quality of the food
No.
in any way.
And in fact, food that is picked when it's ripe is the very best food that you can get. So that's what makes this opportunity so great. So we do this in a local program. So food that is gleaned locally stays local. So if we go to Joe Steiniger's farm in Kansas City, Kansas, and pick turnips, those turnips are going to stay right here in Kansas City.
John, you have something to add?
I'll give you a classic example of what Lisa is talking about. One of the gleanings that took place last year, we wound up receiving about 400 pounds of fresh organic peaches. Now, those peaches had blemishes on it. They had imperfections in the skin that if they went into the marketplace would probably cause people to pick through them and to not take those. We took those 400 pounds of peaches and through our chefs converted those into wonderful fresh peach cobbler that wound up being served to the homeless that we serve at the Greater Kansas City Community Kitchen over on 8th and Paseo. It was a wonderful, nutritious dessert treat for them that we would not have been able to provide if it weren't for the gleaning. And if it weren't for the gleaning that Sosa West does and the connections that they have with the local growers, those peaches probably would have rotted in the fields instead of going to feed hungry people.
That's right.
How does food end up rotting in the fields? It seems like a no-brainer that you would do this gleaning process wholesale with all of the surplus crops, but
happens? You would think that it would be a no-brainer, but this is what they call an understood expense for agriculture. That people understand that produce that's not perfect is not going to sell. So they, rather than pick it and get it and use the labor to get the food out of the field, they or out of the orchard, they will just leave it there to rot. gleaning actually is an ancient concept, started in biblical times, and Society of St. Andrew has brought that process back, giving it a new twist. We work with volunteers to go out into fields and orchards and just simply get what's left after the harvest and take it to a local food pantry or food bank. Harvesters, Harvesters is a very important partner for us, and we work with harvesters to get fresh fruits and vegetables to them all the time. We have two programs. We have a large loads program through which we work with commercial farmers and growers to get large volumes, whole truckloads of potatoes and zucchini and peppers and tomatoes, that type of thing. And we move it to a food bank or an agency that feeds people. And we bring, 2.6 million pounds of fresh produce, mostly delivered to harvesters in last year. That's just our office.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Today we're discussing the activities of SOSA and exploring the inner workings of a group that gets fresh produce from gleaning farmers' fields and salvaging that produce deemed unmarketable at the start, and then given to food banks and food service organizations for the underprivileged. Jill writes, could your guests provide any resources for shaping surplus foods from individuals and organizations? For example, if you have a bunch of leftovers that won't be consumed in time for either a large social family gathering or an organizational meeting, are there programs for that? Does SOSA do that, or is it strictly at the crop or harvest level for foods?
Well, we work to get fresh fruits and vegetables to pantries that feed people. Not leftovers. I would say there is a program. Harvesters has a program called Kansas City Harvest, I think it's still called. Anyway, they work with restaurants on a greater scale to get prepared food to pantries to feed people. John, can you speak to this?
Yes. In fact, we also have a very active food rescue program that will take, for example, food from restaurants, grocery stores, other retailers. Whole Foods Market is a major donor to us for that purpose. Restaurants like Seasons 52 on the Plaza and such. When you're talking about food from things like family gatherings and that type of situation, however, it becomes extremely challenging to do that on a large-scale basis because you get into a variety of different health regulations as far as how that food has been stored, the amount of time it's taken to get that food from one location to another and that type of thing. Typically, if an individual has that type of a situation where from a family reunion or from their own wedding party or something like that, they have some leftovers that they would want to donate, I would probably recommend that they try to go to a local food pantry that is as close to them as possible and see whether or not they will accept that as a donation. But again, the health regulations make that very challenging.
Yes.
Again, as I mentioned, that our guests are Lisa Owsley. She's the director of the Society of St. Andrew, or SOSA West, and John Hornbeck is with the Episcopal Community Services Organization. How do you get a hold, Lisa, of this produce, and who do you typically partner with? You said you have large loads, and you said you have gleaners. Volunteer gleaners. How do you parse all of that together?
Well, we reach out to farmers and growers and packers and other people handling produce. For instance, truckers who have loads of produce that gets rejected, say at a Walmart distribution center outside of Tulsa, will call us and say, hey, we have a truckload of cabbage. It's been rejected by Walmart. Can you help us? Can you help us find a home? And we will look to the closest food bank or agency that can take large amounts of food and contact them to see if it's possible that they could accept this food. That way, the trucker doesn't have to pay to dump the load. The produce company gets a write-off for the donation, and the pantry or food bank gets valuable, nutritious produce. You know, most of the produce on that truck is going to be just fine. Even if it's a high level of waste, even if it's like 40%, that's still 60% of 20,000 pounds or 50,000 pounds of food that's perfectly good to eat and should be eaten by people who need it.
John, you've been out in the fields gleaning. Describe the first time you ever did it and describe the process.
You know, I can't remember the first time. There's been a variety of different ones that I have been on. The one that stands out in my mind the most was a gleaning that we participated in towards the end of this past season. It was, in fact, after the first frost of the season. And believe me, it was an exceptionally cold, cold morning. The thing that I would emphasize the most in terms of the process is it relies so strongly on volunteers, and that is really true throughout all of the hunger relief programs that exist in the city. But this relies on volunteers getting out in the field, picking the crops, putting the crops into appropriate containers, and that will vary sometimes from one crop to another. In this particular instance, it was a combination of turnips and mustard greens. And again, even though it was after the first frost, they were perfectly good. Once those are collected, then those get in turn distributed to one of a variety of different food agencies. One of the advantages of the relationship between SOSA West and Episcopal Community Services is we have some of the same economies of scale that SOSA West has, in that we have multiple kitchens and multiple food pantries. So we can take a fairly significant amount of product and distribute it to those various areas.
Krista from Olathe calls in to share that she donates to her area food pantry through churches and is curious to why so many of the drives rely on canned goods, which are high in sodium. Now, John, you said there's a recent emphasis on nutrition rather than simply feeding. Talk about that.
There is a strong, strong increasing focus on nutrition, and she's absolutely right. Although there has to be some certain level of reliance on canned goods, increasingly both our community kitchens and our pantries are trying to build the amount of fresh produce, both fruits and vegetables, that we're providing in selection to our guests. We feel like it's important from a point of view of variety. We feel like it's important from a perspective of nutrition. And interestingly enough, I had someone the other day that asked us, when we provide, for example, a fresh green salad at the Kansas City Community Kitchen, do the guests actually eat that nutritious food? And the answer I gave to them was absolutely. That, as a matter of fact, it is one of the things that they look forward to, because it is so challenging for some of the guests and neighbors that we help through this program, through these programs, to gain that produce. And again, SOSA West, area community gardens, individual donors like your caller, they are all very, very important sources of that for the Hunger Relief Network.
Lisa, I'd imagine unmarketable is a little bit more of a slippery slope with meats. So the focus is mainly on produce such as fruit and vegetables. But is there an occasional situation where you take meat as well?
Well, SOSA West will help to take any type of food and get it to where it needs to go. We have had hunters call us to tell us that they had deer meat, and would we take that? Actually, what we do in those instances, we connect them with a food bank or a food pantry, depending on the size, and let them work with, because that's where the food will go. That's where the food would be distributed anyway. So we prefer to allow them to work with the food pantry or the food bank to take care of that. But we are the conduit. We are liaison for all sorts of types of things.
What is the picture look like when you get a crop of food into a pantry, John, and you begin to distribute it? How do the chefs look at working with these crops?
Again, it depends upon the type of crop and the quality of the crop. For example, when we received in the turnips and mustard greens, that was something that we were able to immediately send out and distribute for quick distribution at various pantries and community kitchens. At the pantries, they were actually distributed. The pantries work very, very much like a grocery store. Individuals come in, they're given the opportunity to select produce and take it with them. That winds up going back to their home in order for them to prepare that for their meals. The pantries will go through a quick selection process in terms of culling out any vegetables that simply are not appropriate for consumption. But that's really what's necessary there. The flip side of that is the type of situation that we were discussing earlier as far as that crop of peaches, which those, frankly, did not go to a pantry to be distributed directly to a family to take home with them, but rather those were handled by our chefs to make sure that only that product that was appropriate for consumption was used, and those were prepared, were put into a prepared food that in turn would go either to a pantry or, in most cases, to one of our community kitchens.
Those peaches didn't look very good. They were organic, and so they had some spots on them and things like that. And whenever you look at a peach and it's not appetizing to look at, you don't want to eat it. So that was why John processed them like he did.
But, boy, the peach cobblers tasted good to
chefs,
our guests.
Chefs made
Let
magic.
Me tell you.
Chefs made magic of it.
Absolutely.
Excellent.
Carol from Casey Mo shares that her church has formed a garden ministry for this year, and she would like to know, would your groups welcome fresh garden produce planted specifically for the purpose of feeding those in need? Do you work with crops that are planted specifically for the people you serve, Lisa?
Absolutely. And, in fact, we have farmers who plant rows and parts of their fields specifically for us. And if that's the case, we gladly come out and harvest that food and take it to harvesters, or if they have a particular plant pantry in mind, we take it wherever they want it to go.
And how does that process work? How do you partner with farmers that aren't giving you their unmarketable produce but mm-hmm. are allotting a plot on their farmland specifically for you? How does that process come together?
Well, they usually notify us in advance, and we offer to help them with things other than harvesting as well. I mean, if they need help with weeding or that kind of thing for the part that they're going to donate, we're glad to come out and help them. And then whenever the crops are ready, the farmer calls us and says, hey, you guys can come out and harvest. And we simply go out with our volunteers. We put out a call through email to our volunteers, and whoever wants to glean with us meets us out at that field, and we simply pick what's there and take it to harvesters or, again, to another pantry.
John, when you grow out to glean, does the farmer point to where the crops are and you just go gather them? How does that work?
Yeah, you have to be somewhat careful about that at times, because in many cases the farmers, the growers, have a particular portion of their fields that they want to have gleaned. There's other portions of it that are not appropriate for gleaning at that time. It's still part of their crops. So, yes, absolutely. You have to respect what the growers need in order for this program to work, and we very much do that.
And I can help a little bit with that if I can. We work very closely with the farmers to make sure that we pick exactly what they want us to pick. Exactly, we work the rows that they tell us are ready for us to pick. And if they have any special instructions, any special tools that we need to use, we make sure that we have those there. And all of our volunteers are fully instructed in the way that they need to work.
What are some of those special instructions that happen from time to time?
Well, for instance, whenever you pick a peach, you don't just yank it off the tree. You put the weight of the peach in the palm of your hand and lift up and then twist and pull gently. And the peach comes off pretty easily then. But there are a lot of different processes. Sometimes you have to use tools. It's not technical and it's not difficult. And it's something we can usually explain to people of all ages fairly quickly and fairly easily. But there's always people there supervising to make sure it's done right and make sure that the farmer's property is cared for.
John, the instructions are pretty intuitive then.
They're intuitive, but again, one of the key reasons that makes SOSA such a wonderful resource for us to work with is the care that they take in terms of that relationship with the farmers. When our gleaners go out to help in a gleaning, they aren't on their own. It's not a situation where they're going to drive up to a location and wonder, where am I supposed to be? What am I supposed to be picking? What am I supposed to be doing? All of that is mapped out very carefully for them. So, again, very, very important.
Our guests are Lisa Owsley, director of the Society of St. Andrew, or SOSA West, which takes produce that is deemed unmarketable and repurposes it for food banks and other charitable organizations. And we also have John Hornbeck of the Episcopal Community Services, who's here with us discussing the process of gleaning as well. We pause now for a quick break, but when we return, a look at how the food is distributed right here in the community. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Gleaning is the process of taking leftover crops from farmers' fields after they have been harvested for market or on fields that have been deemed economically not viable. It's a practice that served as a form of charity going all the way back to ancient times and has taken root in modern times as organizations look to fight hunger. Our guests are Lisa Owsley, the director of the Society of St. Andrew, or SOSA West, which covers the region west of the Mississippi, and John Hornbeck of the Episcopal Community Services. And joining us now by phone is Catherine Kelly, Executive Director of Cultivate KC. They are all part of the proverbial food chain, making a difference in a region that starts with gleaning and ends with the nourishment of those in poverty. Kathleen Kelly, welcome to the show. Catherine Kelly, rather. Excuse me. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
What's Cultivate KC?
We are a nonprofit organization that helps locally grown food in city neighborhoods. So we support urban farmers who are growing food to feed other people. We help farmers develop small farm businesses, figure out production. And then we work increasingly over the last number of years, we've worked to help connect communities and nonprofits with access to local food, with community-based food projects that help them help their constituencies eat better, eat locally, and really connect to the whole local food movement.
In that vein, Catherine, how long have you worked with Society of St. Andrews, and what does that work entail?
Well, I think it's actually been, I don't remember when the first year was, but it was actually before they even really hit the ground running. So it's been since they got started here in Kansas City. And Lisa and I met really early on and talked about how to connect to the local farming community. I not only have worked in urban communities, but I've also worked with a lot of rural growers. And we have Society of St. Andrews has come out and gleaned our own farm. We have a 2-acre vegetable farm here in KCK. And then we've, worked a lot with them around connecting them to growers' networks.
And how did that connection come together, Lisa?
Well, tell me again what you're looking for.
She said she connected you to growers in the region when the Society of St. Andrews first got here in around 2008.
Right.
So how did all that come together?
Well, it came together with us reaching out to a lot of wonderful farmers. We have a wonderful farming community in and around the metro area, and our farmers are incredibly generous. They are a dynamic group of people, and whenever they have some to give, they are really happy to give it. They really are. They donate food all the time, and we have a lot of farms out around the Kansas City area where we glean as well.
And Catherine, you've gleaned before, I take it, and what's the process like for you?
Well, what will happen is we'll have an abundance of some crop in our field. We have a killer, end of season flush of green peppers, and the frost is coming a couple days down the road, and we know we need to get them out of the field, and we can't necessarily move them. So we'll call SOSA, and with as much advance notice as we can get, and they will send out volunteers, and we show them how to harvest. We, direct them to the part of the field where they can work, and sometimes we will work side by side with them. Sometimes they will work on their own, but then the product, they will also, if we say, okay, take everything, leave us with, four totes worth and take everything else, they'll do that. And then they carry off the produce and get it into the you know, the food distribution networks.
Catherine Kelly, you spoke of frost. Now, we had a drought last year and awkward weather patterns thus far this year. How does weather present a challenge for growers and gleaners alike, or does it?
Well, the weather has been so incredibly changeable, and what that has meant is that farmers, you know, you used to be able to rely on a certain number of weeks of tomato production. Last year, that didn't happen. There were very few of us who had a good full season with really good abundant tomatoes. It just makes your yields and the timing of your yields really variable and unpredictable. So it's crazy making for growers. You know, it's hard. We're running businesses. We need to have product to sell. And it's, you know, it's stressful, you know, financially. It's stressful just, you know, physically. We're really having to learn how to ride this, you know, the weather changes in a different kind of way. You know, as far as society, as far as gleaning goes, I suspect it actually, you know, I haven't had a real direct conversation, but I think it's probably made it a little more difficult for there to be volume in gleaning.
Yes.
because if you have not had, you know, so if you've got a crop in abundance, and it's been a tight financial year, as a grower, a farmer, you're more likely to say, okay, I'm going to really hustle to sell this because I need this extra cash. And you know, it sort of pushes the farmer perhaps to be a little less generous because they're really, you know, their sales in an environmentally changeable year are, you know, a little more closer to the edge than it should be.
And these are real challenges,
yes,
right, Lisa?
Absolutely.
Sosa actually had a problem with floods last year as well.
We had tremendous problems. Last year, weather was a curse to our farmers and it was a curse to us. We had everything from killing frost early in peach growing season, and we had the high temperatures that stunted the growth of the tomatoes. We lost sweet corn because of the heat in July. Again, floods all across Missouri. It was a crazy year, and we know that whenever our farmers are hurting, we're hurting, and that's how that happens.
John, how do you adjust on the ground when stuff like that happens?
With a great deal of difficulty. I mean, as you might expect, the challenges that they're talking about in terms of crops out of the field translate, and crops being gleaned translate very directly into what we're able to provide for the guests and neighbors that we serve in the various hunger relief network ministries. The Episcopal Hunger Relief Network last year provided in excess of 1.2 million meals through our community kitchens, our food pantries, and our other hunger relief programs. That's 20% more than the year before, but that was done through a Herculean effort, partly because of challenges in terms of available produce. The work that SOSA did was extraordinarily important. The support that we get through a variety, an expanding network of community and church gardens, which one of your callers referred to earlier, was extremely important. And really, unless all of these different forces come together, including the urban farmers that Catherine works with, unless all of these forces come together in order to help, in effect, fill the food pipeline for that hunger relief network, it becomes a real challenge to feed those people that need it.
And John, what was the average cost per meal, per se?
We actually, and again, this is in part through donated produce and other resources, we actually have been successful in reducing that over time. It varies from one specific program to another. The per meal in a pantry is a little bit different than the per meal in a community kitchen. But on average, we're running about $1.75 per meal. Now, again, I will say this. That's a lower cost than we had a few years ago, but it is also a significantly more nutritious offering than we were able to provide in the past. So the cost we've been able to drive down, the quality has gone up, and again, that in part is due to organizations like SOSA.
And I would like to mention that SOSA provides fresh, nutritious produce at about 2 cents a serving. So for it's actually 8 cents a pound is what we move it for, but we provide food for 2 cents a serving. That's 50 servings for a dollar. That's an amazing amount of food. And it's because we work with volunteers to get the produce, and we simply get it to pantries and soup kitchens and let them distribute it.
Catherine Kelly, can we revisit how you pick items that are deemed unmarketable and and explain to us how this gets to programs like SOSA and then ultimately down to Mr. Hornbeck's network of food service organizations? Can we revisit that for our listeners?
Yeah, well, it's going to vary a lot. Whenever you sell on the retail market or the wholesale market, we have, as a culture, a really strong emphasis on the cosmetics of food. We're no longer comfortable with, you know, a ding tomato, a spinach leaf that may have some holes in it. And even though those, you know, that's what I eat, that's what all of us farmers eat, is we eat what we call seconds. So it's produce that's less visually perfect, but in fact is you know, equally as high in nutrition and equally as tasty. And so oftentimes what will happen is farmers will take those seconds and make them available through, you know, through Society of St. Andrews or through other hunger programs. We also, though, often have, you know, like there's years where you just be, the squash is just going crazy out in the field, and there's no way you're ever going to be able to move all that, you know, all that zucchini. And so, you know, and everybody has it all at the same time. And so, you know, in situations like that, you know, we'll often donate produce that is absolutely, you know, first quality, and, you know, and it's just Mother Nature has handed us a bounty, you know, has handed a bounty to farmers across the region. So
then some of this is left to chance. You don't come from an organization like SOSA and say, okay, we'd like tomatoes, squash, pumpkins. You kind of take what Mother Nature gives you in a sense.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And we work with everything from apples to zucchini. We really do. We like to say blueberries to watermelon, all sorts of different produce and all sorts of sizes and shapes, fruits and vegetables. And you're right. We work with what's available whenever we're working with gleaning. We also, in our large volume produce project, we work with large volume growers all over the nation to move things like potatoes, staples of the diet. And again, these are B grade potatoes. They're not A quality potatoes, but they're perfectly good to eat.
Catherine Kelly, what's the difference between how a large scale farm might undertake this type of work and how a smaller farm might undertake this type of work?
Might undertake gleaning or distribution?
Gleaning, distribution, the whole potato.
Well, you know, I think that local growers are actually have less waste on their farms because they, you know, the smaller scale you get, you know, there is nobody as productive per square foot as a really good home gardener because they're so focused on that, you know, one plant, that one, you know, 4x6 bed, whatever. So they have very high yields per square foot. As you eat, you know, as you increase, if you know, the yields per square foot go down. So actually, really larger produce farms are less efficient if you do it purely on a square footage or an acreage basis. So if you think of that, so we've got local growers who are growing food and selling it under really tight to non-existent profit margins. They're going to do a real careful job of making sure that, you know, each bit of produce they harvest out of the field is well used. The challenge for them is often one of logistics, you know, where, you know, you've got farmers who are working really hard, crazy hours, maybe hitting multiple farmers markets, and they would like to be able to donate, but they honestly don't have time, which is where SOSA's skill sets come in handy, because they will come out to the farm and make that whole process possible.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Today we're discussing the activities of SOSA as we explore the inner workings of that group and the whole network that takes fresh produce from Gleanings Farmers Fields and salvaging that produce that is at first deemed unmarketable and then given to food banks in the community. Catherine, do you hope to reduce the food waste in farmers' fields? It seems like a pervasive issue nationwide and maybe mirroring somewhat locally. Do you hope to reduce the food waste?
Absolutely. And I would also like to see, you know, farmers are, we didn't used to think of it this way, but farmers who are feeding locally, they're running social enterprise businesses. So there are businesses that have multiple bottom lines, one of which is typically, you know, is helping address food needs, helping address nutritional needs, helping address health needs in the community. And an organization like SOSA helps that business, that helps them meet, you know, one of their multiple bottom lines. And so, you know, as a farmer, I'd like to look out at our farming community and know, you know, in 5 years and 10 years that, you know, yeah, we, you know, same as any corporation that has a corporate philanthropy program, farmers have their hunger program. They have a relationship with an organization that allows them to help address social needs.
John, does this change the way that food service organizations in the community look at local food and look at how food is brought from the field to the table?
It can and it should. It will take some time for that to actually have the scale of change that I would hope that it would. Catherine, interestingly enough, Catherine, Lisa, and myself all sit on the steering committee for the Greater Kansas City Food Policy Coalition. And the area of nutrition and the area of food choices is something that we are all very, very concerned with, as well as the various organizations that each of us in turn works with. And as an example, one of the things that we are paying closer attention to through the Episcopal Hunger Relief Network, as far as those nutritional elements, is when we go into some of the neighborhoods that we're serving, there are higher levels of childhood diabetes and type 2 diabetes. There are higher levels of obesity, which obesity doesn't come about from an excess of food. It comes from the food choices that are made. And by permitting the families in those areas to be able to have broader food choices in terms of more produce, different types of produce, that has a direct impact on a whole host of areas, not only hunger, but also the health of the community. And I think these types of collaborative efforts that are taking place here in this local area, if those are expanded upon, I think they can have a tremendous impact.
Absolutely.
We're on with Lisa Owsley, director of the Society of St. Andrew, or SOSA West, John Hornbeck, whose voice you just heard is from Episcopal Community Services. And joining us by phone is Catherine Kelly, executive director of Cultivate KC. Lisa, what is the organization SOSA most in need of right now?
Well, we like to say we need more food, friends, and funds. We're always looking for new farmers and growers and produce handlers to partner with to get food. We need all the volunteers we can get. We look to faith congregations, rather civic organizations, Rotary Clubs, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, different types of those organizations. We partner heavily with churches to get volunteers and funds. And again, like the third item would be funds. We are very judicious with our funds. We provide food about 96 cents of every dollar that we spend goes right into moving food, goes right into our program. So we need funds. We need support.
And you moved about 2.6 million pounds of fresh produce last year, and you'd like to go to 3 million this year. How do you plan to do
that?
Yeah,
our goal is 3 million this year. So far, we have moved 10.2 million pounds of fresh produce since we opened our office in 2008.
How do you plan to get to 3 this year?
Well, we're working with more farmers and more growers, and we're praying for a good harvest this year for our farmers and for Catherine's laughing. Yeah.
Catherine Kelly, you're laughing.
What is that? Every season is going to be the best season ever. So.
Absolutely, absolutely.
What is the coming harvest season looking like so far as we look forward?
You know, unnaturally warm, but we've all got spinach sprouting out. You know, farmers have been seeding for the last 3 weeks, which is just, you know, normally we don't start until mid-March. And so we are easily, you know, 5-6 weeks ahead of schedule. So there's still, you know, if this weather keeps, we're going to have early harvests on everything across the board. So I'm hoping that it's an indication that we're going to have a nice, mild season with temperatures in the pleasant 80s, rain when we need it, and no rain when we don't.
There. That's it.
Ever the optimist, Catherine.
That's it.
Yep.
And John Hornbeck, how does that potential early harvest affect the way you collect and distribute the food?
What it will do is it will permit us to do more earlier. Is really what it comes down to. It's interesting because echoing what Catherine, part of what Catherine was talking about, we've from some of our community gardens and our network of community gardens, we've already gotten calls from several of them that are nervous about the fact that some of their crops are coming up before what they fear might be the next frost of this season. And I, like Catherine, am hoping that that additional frost doesn't come about. But the longer the harvest, the better the harvest, the more it means for us, not only during the growing season, but through the rest of the season. For example, as was mentioned earlier, we had a horrible time as far as tomato crops last year. In prior years where we have had an abundance of tomatoes, the excess tomatoes that we received during the growing season becomes converted by our chefs and our cooks into salsa, pasta sauce, fresh tomato sauce, all frozen into quantities that can be used in those wonderful December, January, and February months that we experience here in Kansas City. So it really is a year-round abundance when in fact the farms are producing.
And how do you make up for a difference if you don't have a good harvest, which we're crossing our fingers still?
Absolutely. I'll tell you what, last year would have been a dismal year indeed if it hadn't been for our potato growers in Wisconsin. We have growers all over the country, but our potato growers in Wisconsin stepped up to the plate, and we moved about 1 million pounds of potatoes in the last part of the year last year.
We've been on with Lisa Owsley, the director of SOSA West, John Hornbeck of the Episcopal Community Services, and Catherine Kelly, executive director of Cultivate KC, discussing ways that fresh produce is gleaned from farms and given to people in need. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you very much.
And now we look at another kind of food waste, not fresh fruits and vegetables, but processed foods being served in barns and feedlots. Kathleen Masterson from Harvest Public Media has this story.
Every factory that makes food, tomato sauce, oatmeal, cereals, pasta, has some kind of waste. In large-scale bakeries, sometimes loaves get burned or a batch gets misformulated. And it's actually cheaper for both factories and farmers to reuse this would-be waste in animal feed than it is to bury it in a landfill. Often more than 50% of livestock feed is being recycled in some way, says Iowa State University animal scientist Mike Persia.
Animal agriculture is one of the leaders in the green revolution, even though they never really touted that.
Persia says one common example is the oil waste from making soybean oil, the number one product made from soybeans. The oil that's below human grade gets added to livestock feed to fill the fat quotient of their diet. And oftentimes the livestock industry makes use of little things that you might not think of, but really add up. Like, where do all those seeds go that get removed from canned tomatoes?
I know I've done research evaluating tomato seeds, waste products of the tomato canning industry in poultry rations. So that's certainly, both from a poultry and a dairy perspective, something that can occur.
The market for food production cast-offs is big enough that middlemen have gotten into the business. For example, some ag companies buy bakery byproduct, bread, dough, and pastry seconds, and blend it to sell to farmers to mix into cattle feed. Ag Partners is one Iowa company that does this, but they didn't want to say where they purchase rejected baked goods. In fact, some cattlemen were wary to share details, too. Jeff Clausen manages 3,000 cattle in two feedlots in western Iowa.
Where do you get the bakery byproduct?
I guess I'm a little bit sensitive about that because it's pretty competitive. not only between feedlots but also dog food companies in Omaha. They're kind of our competition.
Clausen says they use about 200 tons of bakery leftovers a week. It's not cheap, but he says the cost is usually about 70 or 80% the price of corn.
When corn's $2, it's not as big of an advantage to feed it. But when corn's $6 or $7, then everybody's looking for ways to get corn out of their ration.
With corn and grain prices fairly high, the demand for cheaper livestock feed isn't lost on food manufacturers. The Quaker Oats plant in Iowa, for example, has seen an increased interest in their oat and cereal leftovers. Tom Metalman is senior director of the Cedar Rapids plant.
You know, over the last few years, we've renegotiated a lot of our contracts to be a certain percentage of the corn or oat market, for example. So as the market moves, the value of our byproducts would move as well.
That means when corn prices go up, so does the price for those misformulated batches of oatmeal, Captain Crunch, and Life cereal. Cows and pigs munching on cereals doesn't seem too far-fetched, but even seconds from candy manufacturers make their way into animal feed. The Hershey Company, for one, sells their leftover chocolate to Cargill. But beyond carbs and calories, there's another large source of food waste, from meat processing. Everything from the animal carcass that isn't consumed by humans or doesn't go into pharmaceuticals or pet food gets rendered, says ISU's Mike Persia.
And basically that process is like a large pressure cooker. It uses high temperature and high steam to, you know, degrade the bones, degrade the tissue, any residual meat, any fat.
The meat, blood, and bone meal and the fat are then used in livestock feed, though federal rules bar cows from eating cows because of the risk of mad cow disease. What any individual farmer uses in his feed is partly based on his location and availability, or what company supplies the feed. Most develop specific formulas with their vet or animal nutritionist to get the right balance of nutrients. Some estimate this kind of food recycling saves thousands of tons from going into landfills every year. And that's not to mention the money it can save farmers, especially in the days of sky-high corn. I'm Kathleen Masterson, Harvest Public Media.
And tune in tomorrow as we talk to the cast and crew of a new play tracking urgent environmental issues with sobering musical numbers. Our show is produced by Andrea Salinzi and Charlie Upchurch. Up to Date is next as Steve Kraske talks with former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. I'm Javelani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.